I held that property for 7 years. And when I went to sell it, I was making, I will not forget, $40,000 a year at my, entry-level corporate America job. And I sold the house and I made $100,000. And I was completely blown away. Like, I'm working so hard in my job, slaving in this corporate office to make 40,000 a year, and I just made 100,000. Then that was easy. And so that's sort of when the light bulb went off for me.
Welcome to the Real Freedom Show, where we inspire you to pursue your passion to gain time and financial freedom through opportunities in real estate. I'm your host, Mike Swenson. Let's get some real freedom together. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Real Freedom. We're helping people build time and financial freedom through opportunities in real estate. I'm your host, Mike Swenson. If you want to get started on your real estate investing journey, make sure you check out our website, freedomthroughrealestate.com. That's where we post all of our content, blogs, information for you to be able to help decide what path you want to take inside of real estate. For those of you watching at home, this is possibly a first time event that's happening. We are not out of my office. And thank you so much to our guest, Bonnie, today. Internet had routine maintenance that was happening and it was going to be out for the next hour and a half. So I hopped in the car. We are doing it live from one of my short-term rentals. And the guests are coming to check in here in about 2 hours. So we're going to get everything in and recorded and wrapped up. And so that's the beauty of being an entrepreneur, right? We can be flexible, jump in on the fly and do things like this and still be mobile. So that being said, awesome episode today. I'm so excited. I had the pleasure of meeting Bonnie a couple weeks ago. And I would say quite similar to where I'm at in my journey, she is as well. So Bonnie Wayman, she is with Wild Oak Capital and Aligned Asset Management. And you are based out of Colorado and excited to hear more about your story and your journey in real estate. So welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. Excited to be here.
So just getting started, talk a little bit about your journey into real estate, the early days, just to be able to share kind of why or what is it that's exciting about real estate for you?
Yeah, well, I got into real estate on accident. I became a little bit of an accidental landlord. I was in college and the college required you to live on campus, and I was miserable and paying a ton of money to live on campus. And my parents, who are much smarter than me, were like, why don't we buy a house right off of campus and you can rent it out to your college friends and you can all save money? And I thought that was a good idea. So it happened to be 2008 when you could afford to buy houses in Denver, and we bought a house in Denver and I rented it out to my roommates, which easily covered the mortgage. And I, went to Barnes and Noble at that time and got Real Estate for Dummies and like made a lease and sent it out to my roommates. And I held that property for 7 years. And when I went to sell it, I was making, I will not forget, $40,000 a year at my, entry-level corporate America job. And I sold the house and I made $100,000. And I was completely blown away. Like, I'm working so hard in my job, slaving in this corporate office to make 40,000 a year, and I just made 100,000. Then that was easy. And so that's sort of when the light bulb went off for me. But it took me a while to execute. I think I'm a reasonably risk adverse person. So my husband and I moved out to the country and I kept working for corporate America, but it was just kind of in the back of my mind there. Like, there's something there. And so in about 2016, I started listening to Bigger Pockets, like I'm sure a lot of your listeners did, and had Brandon Turner in my ear all the time and all my drives, and bought my first single family house in 2017. And then I just sort of did, as Brandon calls, like the stack, right? I bought a single family and another single family. And then I went to buy a duplex, but ended up buying a sixplex. And then I partnered with some people, about a couple other kind of in that small multifamily side. And I hope my journey is relatable to other people, because I really didn't do anything special. I just listened to the podcast and then just did exactly what they said, right? So I bought the single family and then I scaled, and there's a local meetup and I went to all the local meetups year after year. And about 4 years into attending the local meetups, there was the guys from Wild Oak Capital at my meetup. And I went up to them one day and said, hey, like, I'd really like to work with some bigger investors. Do you know anybody who might need some operations help? And they said, us. And then I worked my way in and proved myself. And now I'm on the syndication side, and I'm an asset manager for larger multifamily properties. And I have about 500 doors under management.
Awesome. Well, congratulations on that journey. I think to your point, yeah, there's a lot of little decisions that can be made that when all of a sudden you look back, you can see you've come a really far way. I know for me, similarly, my eyes were open to entrepreneurship in college. Oddly enough, I was an entrepreneurship major, but I wasn't willing to take the risk after I graduated. And so a lot of my friends and classmates were either taking over the family company or they already knew what they were doing. And I was like, I need to get a real job because nobody's going to hire an entrepreneurship major at that point. However, I will say the funny thing is I had a friend in college and they had a friend who did what you did, purchased a property. And funny enough, if I remember it right, the dad's name was Kent Jefferson, and they bought a property near the intersection of Kent and Jefferson by my school. And so I thought that was the coolest thing. And so they were living at their house, and it never registered to me because I just thought, oh, I've got to live on campus. And then I start to see what those bills are on campus. It's like, dang, I can live off campus for way less. But because I had financial aid, it was like monopoly money in some ways. So it's kind of like, well, that's just a number that I'll have to take care of later. And then my first flip, we took the proceeds and paid off my college loan. So real estate did help me, but I would have loved to be able to be at that spot where I had the foresight to do something like you did.
Yeah, I mean, I was paying, I think it was $900 a month for my dorm room, and that included a meal plan, but I had some like allergies to the food, so I was hardly eating anything on the meal plan. And when we moved off, I remember we rented each bedroom for $500 per bedroom, and my groceries were like $100. You know, like was so much saving, and I didn't even at that point understand equity and appreciation and all of that. Like I was just like, oh, it's cheaper per month, but it was a great decision.
So on the early side, you had mentioned about slowly stacking up. For people that can't figure out how to do that or can't figure out the finances of that or the money situation, can you talk a little bit deeper about how you were able to execute on that?
Yeah. Two things. First of all, I'll say we were double income, no kids at that point, and we lived well below our means. So we had two, you know, not huge corporate incomes, but we had two good incomes and we saved a lot. We just lived below our means. And then the other thing is, I didn't take a single dollar from real estate for 7 years. Like I just, one property would make a little money and that would just go into the next property. And so I didn't start pulling from any of my real estate investments for 7 years.
Yeah, it's definitely a delayed gratification, and the longer you're
Yes.
able to delay that, the better off that it gets.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I mean, the house hack, we had paid off a good portion of the mortgage and then we were able to take that profit. And so we had very li low living expenses in our personal residence, which allowed us to grow our cash more because our expenses were so low because of that initial house hack.
And I think for people listening, the thing to remember is you don't have to know what to do for the third, fourth, or fifth property. You just need to know what to do for the next property. And some of it I totally get. You want to plan ahead. You want to put yourself in a spot to be able to know what you want to do then. But a lot of it is figure it out as you go. Just get to the next level. And then after that, then worry about the level after that.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. And I know there's some gurus out there who tell you you should buy a 70-unit apartment complex on your first deal. And I disagree because that first deal is probably not going to be great, right? My first deal, I would never buy now. It didn't really cash flow. I didn't really know how to run my numbers despite listening to 200 episodes of Bigger Pockets. And so, but it was a small deal, right? And so I was able to learn on it without risking my entire family's financial future by having purchased a bad 70-unit property, you know? And so I love the stack model. It's not going to get you to quit your job tomorrow, but it is a much less risk averse or yeah, way in order to grow, and you build the skills as you build the types of properties you're buying.
Yeah, we had our first flip. We bought it for, this is like the bottom of the barrel. We bought it for $36,000.
What?
Yeah. That's an inner city low price. And they were going to tear down the house. We found out later that if we didn't buy it, the city was going to tear it down. And so we put in, it was like 20 or 25,000, and then we sold it for 80. So because it was still on the way up, and obviously it's sold for a lot more than that now. But I just think back to those days, like to your point, right? The lessons you learned, it was a much larger margin for error in those regards. And I still have the pictures of our firstborn son, because we had just started having kids at that point, and we rented out a paint sprayer because we're going to paint the exterior of the home in one day. And so we've still got the little picture of him standing by the big paint sprayer as we were, you know, painting the whole house. And so it's those fun memories that, like, I can't even imagine doing that now after having three kids, but it's those fun memories. And it planted those seeds to then be comfortable. And too, from a risk perspective, right? When you take a risk at that, then you're willing to take a little bit bigger risk, a little bit bigger risk, because you have the experience and the knowledge to be able to know how to adjust.
Yeah, one of my business partners and I are always like, does this feel a little bit scary? Good. Then that's about right. Like, this shouldn't keep us up, so we're never sleeping at night because we both have young kids and we want to, protect that. But if we're not feeling a little bit scared as we go to the closing table, it probably means we didn't take a big enough step next.
Are you looking to get started or scale in real estate investing but don't know your next step? Are you overwhelmed thinking about finding deals, analyzing deals, doing due diligence, and managing properties on top of it? Go ahead and push the easy button and invest with us. Real estate investing is what we do full time. We've done dozens of deals with hundreds of doors. We have the knowledge and experience to handpick the best deals that most investors can't find. We've got large off-market deals all the time where you can hopefully find returns and economies of scale that you just can't find on your own. The best thing is it's 100% passive to you for less capital than you put down trying to acquire a property on your own. Don't let this year go by where you don't make the leap, add to your portfolio, or you just sit in analysis by paralysis. To find out more, visit freedomthroughrealestate.com and click on invest. You can book a call and learn more there. So get to scaling your portfolio now with us by your side. Talk about the jump into the multifamily side then, getting a small apartment complex. Also on the financing side, for those that don't know, it's run completely different.
Yeah, you're talking about the like 6-unit apartment complex. It was great. Honestly, it's a lot easier. And I know people say this, that like multifamily is easier than single family, but it really is. Like the financing was simple. The property, it was in 2020, started 2020 when I bought that one. So the market wasn't super hot yet. So it was really, really simple. It is based on NOI and not necessarily the value of the property or what Betty's house next door sold to. And so it makes it less emotional in purchasing. It makes it less emotional in financing. Like the numbers are what they are. And so it's easier to calculate the appraisal, the property closed. I love multifamily. I still love small multifamily, even though I'm on the syndication side as well, because you can own it by yourself. You don't have investors that you're dealing with. It doesn't allow you to scale the same way, but you are just in control more. But you have enough tenants to balance each other out. So if one tenant leaves or is crazy and you have to evict them, you still have, like on that property, five other tenants paying your rent. And that's really why I moved from the single family rentals into the small multifamily, is that consistency in income. And if you have a water heater that goes out and it's $5,000, you still have rent coming in from five or six tenants to help you cover those expenses. Though I also have a CapEx budget saved, but just to, it makes it less risky, less up and down, more consistent if you have more tenants in one building.
And I know, I started with helping people buy a lot of duplexes and triplexes and fourplexes. So moving from that to 5+, where you get into the commercial loan, it's the best of both worlds, because from a lending side, to your point, it is easier. It's a matter of just finding the right properties that fit. And then two, usually, yeah, with a 5-plex, it's still one roof, it's still one exterior, it's still one set of stairs, probably one water heater, probably one, furnace, depending on how it's set up. And so you do have that economy of scale, and you don't have to worry about, like with a duplex, some of my clients, it's like, well, we've got, one person moved out. It's going to take a month or two or three before somebody else comes in. Now I'm only getting half of my income. 5 units, you can weather the storm much better. Four people out of five coming in and paying, you're still getting 80% versus 50%. So just that small shift can make a huge difference. And then growing into the larger apartments, it's that to another level.
Yeah. But it's easier. And again, it's a great stepping stone for the comfort level, right? That was really scary buying that six unit that first time because I went from one to six. But now I feel comfortable with that and I know that I can operate that. So it helps me feel more com it helped me feel more comfortable as I went up into the larger apartment complexes.
Now, talk about Wild Oak Capital and moving to the syndication. So you'd already mentioned you met them at a meetup and eventually joined up with them. So share more about that.
The one thing I missed from my corporate world life was being part of a team. And so I realized that buying rental properties by yourself is great for cash flow, but it's just you, right? And so you're not part of a team. And I missed that camaraderie piece. And so what I realized is that I wanted to be part of a bigger team doing bigger deals and have that relationship piece. I'm a big relationship person. And so I missed that. And so that's what I was looking for when I went up to Eric at the meetup, who's the head of Wild Oak Capital or the founder of Wild Oak Capital. And I have an operations brain. I'm pretty structured. I'm like project management, event management. That's kind of how my brain works. And I went up and I said, you know, do you need someone like that on your team? And he had just been growing. He's a very big visionary. And he was like, yes, oh my God, we need someone to come in and kind of help keep things going on the back end. And what I've seen in the syndication space is that that's really common, right? You have some people with some big visions, big goals. They come in, they raise money, they buy some apartment complexes, and then they're moving on to the next one to buy more apartment complexes. And my role now as the asset manager, and then what I do with Aligned Asset Management is I come in and say, okay, it's great we bought these, but you also have to manage them very carefully in order to get these returns that you've promised your investors before you exit. So that's what I do with Wild Oak Capital. Though now I'm involved on all stages of deals. I help with deal flow and analyzing deals and due diligence, but then also operating that deal to help our investors hit the returns that we promised.
So you're in Colorado. Your focus with Wild Oak is not in Colorado. So talk about purchasing property in other states. And in some ways, people say, like, I get it, it's just another location, but at the same time, it's a little different when you can't just drive down the street and go touch that property or pop in and see how things are doing and, you know, be a surprise shopper and be like, hey, how are things going? How do things look? And so it's that next extension of risk taking, kind of like we've talked about here in the past. So talk about how to work with people and successfully and confidently report to your investors, like, hey, things are going good when you're not eyes on the ground like you are with your six unit.
Yeah. And to be clear, my small multifamily are in Colorado, but they're actually a 5-hour drive away. So I'm even not boots on the ground there. I live in a small, very expensive mountain town. So investing here is mostly silly. So in terms of managing properties where I am not boots on the ground, for us, our property manager is everything. And we actually have formed relationships with a couple property managers, and we will not buy properties where they will not go because it is such a make or break. And like you're saying, I can't pop in and secret shop them whenever I want. And so the trust needs to be there, the relationship needs to be there. We need a sophisticated organization with great people on the ground. And, you know, we do make it a priority to get to our properties. You know, we're probably looking at other deals. Maybe we're looking at another deal in the area. So we'll pop by our property while we've already flown out there. Or if there's a conference nearby, you know, we'll pop over and drive and check our properties. But it's not the same as living in the area where I'm driving by my property every day. So that relationship and that trust with our property managers is everything.
And then talk about the uniqueness of your market versus obviously you just mentioned like being in an expensive mountain town, you can't make it work where you're at, or the numbers don't pencil in the same way. So what is it about your markets and where you're at? Because it's Oklahoma and Arkansas, right?
Yeah, we love Oklahoma and Arkansas, and we're in some different patches of those states. But the cost of living is really affordable. There's population growth, and we have a great tenant base. You know, most of our properties have good working class people. We like the tenant laws in those states for the times that we end up with a tenant that's not so great. We do have a property in Texas. The property taxes in Texas are pretty tricky. We also like Oklahoma and Arkansas. The insurance premiums aren't as crazy as anything coastal. We also, the other thing that's kind of unique about our buy box or our target markets is that we focus more on a little bit smaller properties. So a lot of the institutional groups, they're looking for 200 to 500 unit properties or portfolios. And we've really found luck with the, let's say, 50 to 150 unit properties, where that property is small enough that those large institutional groups aren't looking at it. So we don't have that competition, and we can really be the market experts in those areas for, if an 80 unit apartment complex comes up in Tulsa, the brokers know that that's something that we can operate, we can close on. And our property managers are skilled at operating not only properties, because normally if you're under 100 units or 80 units, you can't really afford a full-time on-site maintenance person and property manager. So those are trickier, right? But you have to choose your hard. And so we choose that hard sometimes and balance, a part-time manager that we split with somebody else, and we're able to get better deals that way.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And, to your point, just to dig in a little bit deeper on property management is like that's huge for people that, yeah, as you're scaling to something larger, it is everything because they're the boots on the ground. They're the ones collecting the rent. They're the ones taking care of the tenants, making sure that tenants feel comfortable and confident and want to stick around. Otherwise, you've got the high turnover. And then as we get into the asset management side, making sure that when you're going to an investor saying, here's what's going to happen with this property, they're actually helping to execute on that too. And you're working with them as the asset manager to make those decisions.
Yeah, absolutely. And even I've worked with property managers outside of ours where they'll tell you whatever you want in the underwriting phase when you're under contract because they're trying to get you as the client. And then turns out, oopsie daisy, they can't execute on that. And so that goes back to the relationship piece with the property managers is we trust, we take deals before we put an LOI out to them and say, here's our underwriting. How do you feel about our rents? Do you think these are achievable? What do you think about our management expenses? Is that something you feel comfortable with? So that when we close, when we're pitching this to our investors, we feel confident this is actually something we can execute on. Not the property manager was just selling us these numbers so we would choose them, and now we're not going to be able to hit that.
So you've got a few folks with Wild Oak. So talk about as you grow and you've got a group of people working to acquire properties, maybe how you guys split up the workload and how that works out based on interest level and skills and abilities.
I'm really blessed to be part of the Wild Oak team, and there's some incredibly, actually, everybody on the team is incredibly smart. It's taken some work. There's about five of us that are involved in the process. We have someone on our team who's an expert in underwriting, and so he's always the first person. Donovan is his name. He does the first round of underwriting on all our deals and tells us, like, are we even ballpark to do the offering? And then Eric is the best at negotiations and broker relations. And so oftentimes Eric is the person taking that LOI and working with the brokers. Shane is on our team. He's maybe one of the smartest people I've ever met in the way that his brain can see numbers and understand properties and understand neighborhoods. And so Shane does a lot of kind of the planning for the property and where it can go. And then I'm doing a lot of the numbers in the background and a lot of the coordination with the property managers and renovations and CapEx and vendors. And then Ben is also great with brokers and contracts. And so it's like every little piece kind of moves between us. And it has taken us a while, I would say, to get our rhythm where we're not stepping on each other's toes. But also putting in where our skill sets are.
Yeah.
And then capital raising, of course.
That was going to be my next question is capital raising. So talk a little bit about how you have the deal set up and how you're going to investors to have them partner with you.
So all of our deals we do are 506B, so none of them are marketed. So it's all relationships. And I will say this is not my strong suit. I would say I'm the asset manager. I am not particularly involved on the capital raising side. So Eric, Ben, and Shane are the main people who do the capital raising for our group, and I try and stay in my lane and stay focused on the asset management piece. But they have built relationships with people and successfully done deals, which also helps bring more people after you've gone full cycle through a deal. And so, sending the emails and following up with investors, that's all their lane.
And it's cool to see all those different pieces work together because there's a lot of work to do, especially as you get to a portfolio of your size. And so to have a great team where everybody's working in unison, it's awesome.
It is amazing. And I also think, from the asset management side, we've gone out and like gotten other clients, and it has really helped me appreciate how much I like the people, the guys at Wild Oak. It's a lot, and it's stressful when you're talking the last 30 days before closing and lenders are changing their mind and investors are backing out. Like, it's a stressful thing. And so to work with people that are good humans is the most important, right? Because it's gonna get sketchy at some point. Things are gonna get funky, and you have to be on the same page as your colleagues, and you have to know that they are good humans and that you trust them to do the right thing. And so I'm incredibly grateful for that. I don't think that everybody has that experience in this space. And it's the most important thing for me, right? Work with people that are smart, that are good people, that are also fun, and you can go have a beer with and relax and enjoy.
Let's dig in a little bit to the asset management piece, kind of your calling card or your specialty here. So talk about what you do on the asset management side, how that looks, and why it's so important to what we're feeding our investors.
Yeah, I'm going to use a little analogy that I think is helpful, and it's a football analogy. So, because a lot of people get asset management and property management confused. And that makes sense. For the most part, asset management is on bigger properties. So let's say 20 to 50 units and above, you probably have an asset manager. If you're talking about a duplex, you do not need an asset manager. You just need a property manager. So, but on a bigger, more complicated deal, the asset manager on a football team is the coach, and the property manager is the quarterback. And so the asset manager or the coach is coming into the game with a big game plan. They did a bunch of research on the competitors. They did a bunch of planning with their team. They have their budget and their uniforms and all of this stuff planned for the game. And then they have the whole game plan laid out, and they tell the quarterback to go execute. And then your quarterback is your property manager. They're the boots on the ground. They're throwing, they're blocking, they're tackling, like, they're in charge of what is happening on the field. And I always say, like, if you have a great quarterback or a great property manager, you might give them a little bit more space to make a play call. But if that's somebody new, if that's your redshirt freshman out there, you're going to hold those strings a little tighter and be a little bit more involved. And so that's the same with asset management and property management. Like, if we're taking over a new property and we have a new property manager, we're going to be talking every week. I'm going to be looking at every single number. And then as we build that relationship and as they get more experienced with our standards, then maybe that goes to every other week. So the asset manager is in charge of executing the business plan. And this is often on the syndication side where we pitched investors at the beginning, "Hey, investor, here's your cash on cash. Here's our plan to renovate the units and increase rents $100 per unit. My job is to take that, look at the big picture, and say, okay, how are we going to execute this day by day to hit that long-term goal?" So I'm working with the property manager saying, okay, we have three units coming up. Which ones are we going to renovate? To which level are we going to renovate? How much are we going to spend on that renovation? And what's the ROI? How much do we need to make in rent growth to make that renovation worth it? Or should we just paint it and put a new floor and put someone in? What's the better spend? So those are the types of decisions that the asset manager is making, and why you need an asset manager and a property manager for a higher level property. The other thing I do a lot of is on our team, I do investor relations as well.
I mean, hugely important because, you know, let's just say quick and dirty numbers. If we tell somebody, you know, we're going to double the value of this asset in 5 years, buying something for, let's say, $2 million, and then we sell it for four. Well, if the property manager doesn't do a good job, or if the asset manager doesn't do a good job, you might hit at $3.5 million and leave $500,000 on the table. So like those things are really important. So I think a lot of times we focus on getting a good deal, which is really which is also really important.
Also
However,
important.
if you can't take the value from where it is to where it needs to go, then yeah, you have to answer to your investors and say, we missed the mark here. And so how did we miss the mark? And that's the value of the property management and asset management. You've got to have the strategy and they've got to execute the strategy.
Right. And you think about your property manager on site. They're dealing with maintenance orders and angry tenants. And I mean, it is a thankless job. Bless the people on site. And but they have a unit coming up and they know their goal is to keep occupancy at 95%. So if there's not an asset manager looking at the bigger picture, that property manager, not because they're not intelligent, but just because they're just in the weeds trying to get things done, they're just going to flip it and rent it out for whatever it rent will get somebody in the door, right? And again, that's not because they're bad. It's just because they're in the weeds and they're really busy. And so if you can just keep that higher level perspective to help them be like, hold on, I know we need that occupancy, but should we renovate this unit? You know, that's how you keep your business plan on track because you can't buy an apartment complex is a business. You can't just buy it, hand it over to the property manager who has thousands of clients like you, and expect that in 5 years it's going to be ready to sell.
And in a lot of ways, I mean, no fault of their own. We all do this at times. It's a little bit of the path of least resistance, right? Like we're gonna choose to do something more challenging or just do what we need to do because it's easier at the time. And like I remember as an example, we got a quote on a project that we were working on and we got the bid back and it was a little bit higher than what we had thought. And so I went back to the property manager and said, hey, is this truly the best you think we can do? Should we reach out to somebody else? Or like, if this is somebody that you've worked with before, they're very reliable, then maybe this is the path that we move forward with. Well, he's like, I'll see what I can do. Come back. It's like a week and a half or 2 weeks later, and we got a quote that was about 30% less than what that quote was. And so now, if that person does a bad job, then it might end up costing us more than the original quote. So then I'm coming back to the property manager saying, hey, do you feel comfortable in this quote? Do you feel like these people can execute it at a level that it's going to get the job taken care of? And so it's just that little bit of extra accountability there that's going to make a big difference. But, you know, we just saved thousands of dollars on the bottom line, assuming this company can do a good job, but we're still putting our trust in the property manager to vet the people that they're working with as well, because they've worked with them on other jobs for other properties for other people.
Yeah, I always say asset management and why I love it is it's a balance of people and numbers, right? So there's that trust and the relationship and the communication. That's part of the role. And then it's also looking at the numbers. And it's like this whole puzzle of people and numbers together.
Absolutely. Anything more that you want to add here that we haven't covered yet?
No, I think this has been a fun conversation.
Well, thank you so much for coming on and sharing. For people that want to reach out to you, learn more about you and Wild Oak and Aligned Asset Management, how can they do so?
Yeah, I actually have a website, which is just bonniewayman.com. It's BonniewayMan.com. And there's links to Aligned Asset Management as well as Wild Oak there and a contact form. I'd love to hear from anybody. I can talk real estate all day, so would love to hear from anybody.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Bonnie, for coming on. We appreciate it. Excited to see what you guys continue to do and how you can continue to grow. It'll be a fun ride.
Thanks, Mike, for having me on. I appreciate it.
When you look at getting started, there's really two things that matter quite a bit, right? One is, can you find deals? And two is, can you find capital? And for me, like my background was all in sales and hunting, and I had a good network of people around me. So I'm like, let me go partner with people I've worked with and play more of a role on the investor relations capital side of the house, where I've kind of dove deeper in that area versus on the operational side.
Welcome to the Real Freedom Show, where we inspire you to pursue your passion to gain time and financial freedom through opportunities in real estate. I'm your host, Mike Swenson. Let's get some real freedom together. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Real Freedom, Real Estate Leveraged Freedom, where we talk about different ways that people build time and financial freedom through opportunities in real estate. I'm your host, Mike Swenson. If you want to get started on learning more about what your journey could look like, check out our website, freedomthroughrealestate.com. We've got articles, all of our podcast episodes up there to be able to get started because nobody's journey is the same. Everyone's different. And we decide to interview quite a wide range of people to be able to share different stories. We want to find something that resonates with you, where you're going, what you're excited about. There's so many different things that you can do inside of real estate. So we're excited to be able to show different people's paths for you. Today, we've got Sam Silverman here. He is the founder of Silverman Capital and host of the Freedom Framework Show. A lot of experience, capital raising, syndications, buying businesses as well, kind of putting it all together, have an awesome community of people doing the same. And so you're changing a lot of lives. And so Sam, we're excited to hear you share your story. So welcome to the show, Sam.
Yeah, Mike, thanks for having me on.
Why don't we get started? Maybe talk about a little bit about your background, getting into real estate, kind of what was it for you? And we'll go from there.
Yeah, so I got in, like I think a lot of people do, where I was in sales. I started earning more money. My lifestyle didn't creep up. And, you know, all I really knew was, hey, passive income, buy some rentals, right? Started buying single family rentals. I built a portfolio of call it 10 houses. And I quickly realized that I absolutely hated it. And what I found was that being in the role that I was in, right, I was in a sales role where if you perform really well, you can make 3 or 4x what you should make. If you didn't perform well, you'd make half of what you should make and be close to getting fired every single month. And for me, the trade-off of the time, effort, headspace that went into managing that portfolio of single-family rentals was not worth the opportunity cost, right? People usually look at opportunity cost in dollars. This was a direct correlation to my performance, my job, and to like my mental well-being. So sold the whole portfolio off. Luckily, at the time, Zillow was still buying homes. And started investing into deals as an LP. I got into about 20 or so deals as an LP. From people I met on podcasts, YouTube, right? Different places of kind of, you know, going through content, interviewed folks, found some good people to invest with, got about 20 or so deals, and then realized that there's opportunity in the more active side and started syndicating my own deals, partnering people in any kind of a fund-to-fund capacity, and just getting much more involved and pretty quickly.
So where were your single family homes?
They were in a submarket of Jacksonville, Florida, like St. Augustine-ish area in the close downtown, but still forest land area. That's where they were.
Okay. And is that where you lived at the time?
No. It was probably like 3 or 4 hours from me. So I had found the first property I bought on roofstock.com, which was like a single family transaction place. It's supposed to be totally turnkey. It was nowhere near turnkey. Horrible experience overall buying through them. And found the seller on the closing documents, called him from a connection I found on LinkedIn. And I'm like, hey, if you have more of these properties, I'll go buy them. We can save the real estate commission and stuff too. Long story short, the owner was a builder and under a level of financial distress. So I ended up buying 2 properties at a time from him every 45 days in cash and would do delayed financing. Because I was just covering his build cost because he was underwater credit-wise. So essentially I ended up with like 10 houses there, probably $50,000 in cash all in, because I was able to pull my cash at every transaction through delayed financing. And great experience, and also gave me a lot of clarity too on what I don't want to go do going forward as well.
Yeah, that's one of the things that, you know, I share with people is part of getting into real estate is to figure out what you like and what you don't like. And I think a lot of times people don't leap in because they're scared of screwing up or doing something wrong. And they think that wherever they get into real estate is going to be where they land. And so it curves and it changes. And so obviously you realize the single family life wasn't for you. Get out and sell it. Now, did you sell all of them to Zillow?
Every one of them.
Okay.
Every awesome. One of them, which was awesome, right? Because these are probably $250,000 give or take homes. And most people buying a home that price point, it's an FHA loan, which means that they're putting 3.5% down where there's no money for contingencies. Your appraisal comes short, oh well, right? So it's those people typically, right? If you're putting that much money down, you likely don't have the cash to go make up an appraisal gap. Or if the financing doesn't come through properly, you have huge risk of doing it, right? So they were offering above market rate with a 1% commission versus a 6% commission. And just a all cash buy transaction. It was a no-brainer, and I'm super grateful they were still buying homes at times because the other side of that transaction, like the likely buyers of those homes, would have a lot of risk in a transaction as well, and likely a lot of headache on my end too to go do it for most likely less net proceeds. So I got super lucky they were still buying homes at the time. And again, people ask too, is like, hey, single family a great route to go? I got lucky as the timing of when I bought them and how I bought them, right? So I don't necessarily think single family is a good way to go for anyone going forward. I think it's a good, it worked out well for me. A lot of it based on luck and timing of when it was, not because it's something like creative or innovative or just like a lot of luck as it ties to it.
So then after that, went into becoming a limited partner on syndications, correct?
Yeah, it's about 20 or so deals. After that, too, can use the proceeds I got from those homes. I think it was like $1 million or so in total. And then just broke it up into about 20 deals over the next, 6, 9 months in placing capital.
For people looking that have money, I think, syndication is a great opportunity for people to get into real estate without having to do a lot of the work themselves. Obviously, they're really tying themselves to the relationship of the person that is managing that property and kind of running that as the operator. But talk about, being able to maybe diversify or kind of what were you looking for in those deals?
Yeah, so I think like anything, you're betting on the people, right? In a deal like that where you're hands off, the biggest thing you're betting on is who are those people and do I feel confident in them to be ethical, to execute a business plan? Do I feel aligned to the actual strategy itself? So on mine, I think at this time I was like 23, right? So I didn't really care about cash flow. I just want to get exposure. I kind of viewed all of that as like a big learning experience. So most people wouldn't take the same route I took in doing it because not that I didn't care about the money. I really viewed it as more of an exposure and kind of entry point to it versus saying I need to go maximize every dollar of return and scrutinize everything there. I was much more carefree with how I allocated the capital, right? So, but when kind of looking at it now, like how I really go do things, I definitely go bigger allocations and less deals now, right? Versus the smaller allocations kind of and super widespread just for, ease of tracking too, honestly, and ease of relationship. Like the biggest thing I look at is one, the people, they have skin in the game. And I mean less so capital, more so as it relates to reputational risk. Like someone's first deal, right? They have no likely brand equity. So for example, if you have Joe, the brand new guy syndicating a deal starting out and he has to go shut down, no one really cares, right? If you work with a bigger name group, right? There's a level of brand equity they need to go hold intact, right? If you lose a dollar of someone's money, it costs you way more than a dollar. If I lose a dollar of my own money, it costs me a dollar, right? So you kind of look at it from that level as well too. Making sure the deal itself aligns with the intention you want, whether if you're looking at if you're, 65 years old and living off of your cash flow, put your money into a venture capital type deal that has no cash flow and will go 0 or 50x, maybe not the best route for you to go pick, right? So it's understanding, does this deal in intention line up with what I want to go do? And then lastly, it's do I believe in the market, the asset class, the macro environment? Do I feel comfortable with the sponsors, fees, term, structure? Am I protected in that way? But again, to me, it all starts with the people that you're working with all day long.
For sure. So was a lot of that then apartments?
Yes, we did apartments. We did single family portfolios of homes. We did mobile home parks. We did storage. We did debt. Like most things you can name in real estate, I've at least, test the waters in.
So then getting to deciding to do your own syndications, I'd love to hear kind of your thought process of moving along those lines.
Yeah, so when you look at getting started, there's really two things that matter quite a bit, right? One is can you find deals? And two is can you find capital? And for me, like my background was all in sales and hunting, and I had a good network of people around me. So I'm like, let me go partner with people I've worked with and play more of a role on the investor relations capital side of the house, where I've kind of dove deeper in that area versus on the operational side. And the reason was that I was still working a full-time job. I was a VP of sales at a big company, a very demanding type role. And what I didn't want to have happen was I have a deal I'm working or managing, and my work picks up in a massive way. And I have to go neglect that deal for whatever reason in terms of time. I don't want to put people's money at risk because of my time being spread thin in certain ways, right? When you're kind of playing the role as a fund manager, a capital partner, right? Your operational, involvement can be minimized at times for the people who are playing bigger roles than yourself. So it allowed me to go be involved, but also, own less of deals, right? Kind of play roles that allowed me to go do both at the same time. Because I'm a big believer too, if like, don't go leave your job and go start something new if you have nothing built, Like go build it, then go leave. So for me, I spent, 2+ years building it while I had a job still. So understanding my time capacity and like headspace and what I can do to go work with it allowed me to go build it while having the job and then transition once that was stabilized to a point of becoming an actual business.
Yeah, for sure. That's great advice for people. And if you have the luxury to be able to do that and want to do that, yeah, hold your job as long as possible. Are you looking to get started or scale in real estate investing, but don't know your next step? Are you overwhelmed thinking about finding deals, analyzing deals, doing due diligence, and managing properties on top of it? Go ahead and push the easy button and invest with us. Real estate investing is what we do full time. We've done dozens of deals with hundreds of doors. We have the knowledge and experience to handpick the best deals that most investors can't find. We've got large off-market deals all the time where you can hopefully find returns and economies of scale that you just can't find on your own. The best thing is it's 100% passive to you for less capital than you put down trying to acquire a property on your own. Don't let this year go by where you don't make the leap, add to your portfolio, or you just sit in analysis by paralysis. To find out more, visit freedomthroughrealestate.com and click on invest. You can book a call and learn more there. So get to scaling your portfolio now with us by your side. Talk a little bit about this community that you're building with people. Obviously, it can be lonely. Networking is really important. You know, there's a ton of value of networking with other like-minded people. So how did that idea come to be?
I honestly started the community by accident, right? At first, I was in another group that was somewhat similar to actually what I originally started with. And I'm like, I can do this differently. And in my opinion, with less frills for much more effective price when you get more people access, right? I think what happens for certain people is that when you start having some success in a given area, a lot of people reach out to you about something, right? Asking for help, asking for advice. And in turn, like, okay, I'm having the same conversation over and over and over again. And selfishly, when you first start too, like you'll talk to anyone, right? When you're first starting a business. As you get more further along in your journey, you say no far more often because you have to go protect your time. And I was having all these people reach out to me with the same questions over and over again. And I needed honestly somewhere to go push them to that I can go solve all those same problems at the same time. So in turn, rather than taking on a very high, 4-figure hourly rate for consulting, I'm like, why don't I go make this much more attainable for people as it relates to cost? And they're asking all the same questions. Why don't I go record content, bring in coaches to go support other areas that I have less competency in, right? Because I know there's a few things I'm pretty good at and a lot of areas that people way better at than myself. Let me go bring those people in to go help support the members as well too. So it kind of stemmed from the angle of like, to give an example, when I first started out in the corporate world, I'm like, hey, if I can make 100K, I'll be in great shape. Then I saw people making 200 grand. If I can make 200K, I'll be in great shape. And it's been making $400,000, then a million. Then you start realizing too, hey, these people are making $1 million, but they're miserable in their life in the corporate world. And I'm like, okay, there's a better opportunity to go do things. We actually have ownership, do them your way, right? And you have a better overall balance of life. So I think being around the right people helps you think differently, right? I think there's a huge opportunity right now where people are kind of waking up to realize it is that I want to be able to go have control of my time. I want to go own things that are actual business. I want to have a level of brand equity versus just working for someone else my entire life too. So it was kind of a culmination of a lot of those things. And I think a huge value of just having people who have been there and done that in certain scenarios, you can go ask questions to. Like, again, all this information that we share in the community is free. Almost every group that you're joining, you can go find the stuff that they're teaching in that group on YouTube, on podcasts, in different books, right? But you're paying for the speed of execution and people there you can go reach out to, people there you can go dive deep into a deal with. Like early on in my career, there were deals I would have paid 6 figures to not have done that I did, right? Just from the awareness of I didn't understand certain things. So that's a huge piece of it. And people around you who are all focused on doing things similar, even if in different ways, is hugely, hugely valuable. Like at times when I was in the corporate world, hey, I'm going to go leave a job where I'm making $600,000 a year to go do my own thing. People are like, you're out of your mind. And people around you can go talk to and relate to and who want similar things to themselves, even if the path they take to get there is still a little bit different than how you would do it. So I think just a combination of all those areas is kind of why we put a lot of effort into building this.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Like you said, and I hear this from a lot of people of like, yeah, I can learn anything that I want on YouTube. The hard thing is the connection of the right piece of information at the right time, or being able to bounce an idea off of somebody that's been there and done that and save you, like you said, the speed of execution, being able to save you time, maybe going down the wrong paths.
Or buying the wrong deal, right? Like right now, In real estate, there's a little bit less variance where if you buy a bad deal, it won't kill you in terms of like bankrupt you. If you buy a bad business, it can bankrupt you 100%, right? Because most people, if you're buying a business that say is doing, $1 million a year of EBITDA, right? And you're buying it for $3 million, putting $300K down, you're taking an SBA loan out for $2.7 million, that could bankrupt a lot of people, right? If that deal goes south, it's personally guaranteed. So I think part of what having a group of people around you, whether it be coaches, mentors, people you can go relate to in a similar spot to yourself, of passing on certain deals is actually the best thing you can go do, right? Like we had a student recently who we got in a call with that was under contract in a deal too, and it was a bloodbath. And like them passing that deal will hopefully save them millions of dollars in the future. So it's not always what you buy, it's more just what you don't buy and how you choose to allocate your time and resources going forward as well.
Now, you'd also mentioned about buying businesses in addition to real estate. So talk about for folks considering that, or even too, as a way to escape a W-2 job, maybe by buying a business instead of buying real estate to replace that income. Would love to hear kind of your thoughts of moving in that direction.
Yeah, so I think when you look at buying real estate, you likely need a few transactions to replace your income. So take first multifamily. Most multifamily, if you do it right and you're buying kind of smaller stuff, not the 100 unit plus stuff, right? That you're building a whole business around. But if you're buying some smaller stuff, right? The 8, 12, 60 unit properties, you likely need, 40, 50 doors to go replace 10, 15K a month of income. If you structure it in a way where you're kind of raising some money as debt, raising some money as kind of decent equity in it, right? You probably need 40, 50 doors to go replace that call 10K a month income. When you look at doing that through real estate or start through buying a business, you may only need one transaction. So like a good rule of thumb is if you're looking to get replaced, call 10K a month, and you buy a business doing $400,000 a year of profit, right? You probably have about $150,000 going to your SBA loan, and you probably have 100K going to your manager, going to a manager or GM to go in place. And you have $100,000 left for yourself there as well, assuming no growth, nothing else. So it's definitely harder to go find one good business to go buy, but one transaction you can go replace your income much more quickly. So what I say is it depends, right? Some people like the real estate can be a great slow burn if you go buy deals, you're disciplined, right? Like very predictable path to be done. Thousands and thousands of people have done it with multifamily. Like it's a great route I'm going to do so, especially if you're buying deals that are smaller, like think stuff sub 50 units. Once you're above that, you're competing in deals that are trading at what their actual market value is, right? When you're buying below that, you're truly getting a good basis on a product because you have more unsophisticated sellers and buyers in that market. So I think you have more opportunity there. But again, it really depends on what route you want to go do. Like there's tons of different ways to go do it, and not what like one's not right, one's not wrong. It's figuring out what do you want your life to look like, what path you want to go take to get there, what timeline do you want to go have, and what pains or stressors are you okay dealing with? Right. So every scenario is different, and they'll all have different pains and with it.
Now, I know we could spend hours and hours talking about the business piece, but for those people that are curious, like buying a business, like the example you gave, 400K, people are probably asking, like, why would that person sell their business if it's making money and they could just hire a general manager to replace their time and just keep that income? Why wouldn't they do that versus selling it?
So it really depends. Like if you look at it, there's a huge shift in ownership, right? Most people, they call it half businesses now are owned by people who are in the baby boomer category, where they may not have an actual succession plan. They may not have the systems and processes to do so. So for example, right now I run a fund called The Pave. We're going and buying paving companies. And a lot of these owners are pavers, right? They have done the work themselves for generations, and they're not particularly the best businessmen always. Right. For them, they're great at paving, right? But in terms of operational process, in terms of like things are held together at times with, duct tape and paper clips, right? Like it's not actually run how business should be run, but they have enough scale where it doesn't matter to them. Like for them, taking the business from doing, $1 million a year, $2 million a year, just extra headache. Like for example, we bought a company recently that didn't even have a website, right? So like things like that allows for so much opportunity. So what I'd say is that owners are tired, right? They're over it, right? Because they've been doing a lot of the work themselves. So there's a great value in finding companies in which you can go replace the owner through a manager in a certain way. There's a lift in doing that process, but for a lot of owners who have been trapped by their business at times, it becomes tough, right? Or they look at it as, hey, I've had my time, I want my payday, and I want to call it a day. Or they may not even realize that they can actually go sell it. So there's a lot of different reasons that someone actually looks to go sell for it.
I like that strategy too of, yeah, like you mentioned, finding one good business can certainly make up for a lot of real estate deals. And then at least that gets you out of a W-2 job, gives you a chance to make some money on your own or add to it to be able to save up and put different places. And it's all kind of about starting that snowball that's just going to continue to grow and grow over time.
For sure. And it's how I view it is that if you can go get to a place where you've covered your monthly expenses, right? And you can go be more intentional in what you want to go do. So, for example, we have a friend in my community as well too, who he got kind of his freedom by multifamily, right? He had 40, 50 units, replaces, 12, 15K a month of income, and he's now good. But now he's like, hey, I want to go build a business around flipping houses. And now I'm going to build a business around syndications, right? Which are potentially longer term plays. So for him, now that he covered his short term, right, his livability, he can go think differently and bigger in the long term and delay the gratification on it and go potentially shoot for bigger goals around things. So again, not a right or wrong answer. It's just kind of solving for what gives you the optionality to be more selective as to what you want to go do.
As you've, kind of picked up a lot of experience along the way, what are you going to be focusing on here for kind of the next season for you?
So real estate, less so for me right now. Definitely more in kind of partnering on businesses. I think there's different levers that can be pulled there right now. So I'd say more so on the buying business piece of it, both in things that I personally own, right, like an accounting firm right now, or things that I can go get a level of scale to along with investors, right? So I'd say it's kind of two main buckets, right? Things that I own myself, then also things that I kind of partner with investors on to have a level of scale.
For people that want to reach out to you, learn more about what you're doing, how can they do that, Sam?
Yeah, so super active on LinkedIn. And then our podcast is the Freedom Framework Show. We also have a new YouTube channel under Sam Silverman Official as well.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on and sharing. Excited to hear where you're going to continue to grow, and best of luck to you in the future.